and a half. Coming up to speed, I apologize for missing this morning's proceedings. It's obvious that the tailwind we thought we were riding in on today, in terms of the preparation of the document and the alternatives, has changed. It's more of a headwind now. And I talked over lunch, I talked with the executive director and Tom Neese, the staff. And it's my impression and recommendation that at this time we don't have a document we can move forward with. I don't think the alternatives were built upon the information that we have now. As much as I want this council to maintain control of groundfish management and to work within the process that we work with, I don't think we're there. And if there's anybody at the council level that wants to challenge that, please raise your hand. That doesn't mean, in my impression, that doesn't mean that we stop working on 16. I think there's still elements of 16 that we should talk about today during this time. There are a series of motions that have come up from the AP and the committee that I think we should look at today. I'm sure in the back of your minds, just like in the back of my mind, what does this mean? How do we adapt? How do we change our timeline? When are we going to finish this thing? And I think at this point, my recommendation would be that the executive committee take whatever discussion the council has today about that point, about the timeline and the scheduling of meetings, and come up with a revised timeline that will probably hinge greatly on the GARM. So we may have some development work that we can do this summer through the committee and the AP. We can talk about that. But I think we're looking at probably taking action somewhere around November, December, to send the document out to the public. So that would give us 2 or 3 months to take a look at the GARM and make adjustments to our alternatives. There may be differing opinions. We can talk about that. We may be closer than we think. Maybe we can take the vote in October, but at this point, I don't think we can, which would mean you're taking final action sometime in late winter next year. So, you know, before we get into the alternatives or the motions or anything else of particular significance in 16, if any council members want to speak to the points that I just raised. Dr. Pierce.
Well, I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, my agency, as well as Maine DMR, George LaPointe, we've sent a letter to the council, copied to the council, the letter that went to NOAA Fisheries regarding the merits, the reasons for a six-month delay or some reasonable delay that would enable us to respond to GARM advice, the new biological reference points, the National Standard Number 1 guidelines, not a postponement, but just a necessary change in the timetable to deal with reality. In light of the information that's been provided to us today, clearly there'll be a lot of work for us to do between now and the fall, but that work is going to be contingent on thoughtful consideration of, once again, what comes out of the GARM, without already having had a preview of what might come out of the GARM. The options we have before us right now, the four options regarding effort control that we'll, I suppose, discuss today, this afternoon, they're options that pretty much spell the end of the groundfish fishery in New England, and they'll have some significant impacts on other fisheries that take groundfish as a bycatch. Of course, we have no way of knowing how this plan, how this amendment will eventually look. That is, after we get the GARM advice. But I would much rather move forward in a reasonable way, a reasoned way, with the information in hand than to offer up now to the fishing industry and to others for review an Amendment 16 document that likely will have no resemblance to what we'll eventually piece together later on this year in the fall. So I agree with you. Of course, we already have heard the views of the four senators. Senator Snow's staffer expressing those views earlier this morning. Senator Kennedy, Kerry, Snow, and Collins, they've made their concerns quite clear. So your suggestion certainly makes sense in that context. I know that you've worked very hard behind the scenes to try to come up with, as acting as chairman, to come up with a strategy that would enable us to adopt today a document that would go off a public comment. And I know that you've been working on some possible timelines that would relate to that strategy. But in light of what you've just said, it seems that what you've heard regarding this morning's discussion, you've rethought that, and you don't wish to move forward or recommend that we move forward in that direction. So I stand to be guided by your views, which are, well, the views of my agency, and, of course, MANDMR and likely some other state agencies as well.
Jim Alden.
Yeah, having worked on this committee for, a year and a half on this, coming up with different options to try to meet a goal that we may or may not have had to meet, we've come to realize that what we did was just that. We came up with goals that weren't accurate, and we have no idea where we are. I agree with your initial read about putting this off, and we can work on some things on the sector stuff today. But I think in light of that, all of this stuff is still very preliminary, that until we have a final GARM, it's going to be impossible for this committee to work on coming up with solutions. We tried it. We couldn't do it until we have information in it. So I would say, if we're going to put it off, let's put it off, get the right information, and let the committee deliberate and do the job right the first time, and then move forward from there. If it takes us into next winter, that's where it takes us. But we have to do the job we think is right with the right information. So rather than just jump into doing the same thing we've been doing in the next 2 months, we need to wait until we have the final information and then develop plans accordingly.
Okay. George?
Well, I'm sure you all know we've strongly encouraged the council all along to meet the May 1, 2009 deadline, and this is a milestone to do that. So obviously we're disappointed to be in this place, and this isn't where I thought we'd be just a few days ago. But I think knowing what we know now, not taking action today probably is the sensible thing to do. And I would encourage you, though, to have your PDT start to look at this preliminary information as an indication of what kind of measures might be appropriate pending the final outcome of the GARM and the inclusion of the 2007 data. So I encourage you to keep moving forward as quickly as possible, but I understand that probably doesn't make sense to vote out the document today.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I absolutely concur with your proposed strategy. My thoughts are much the same as Dr. Pierce's and Jim's. We've worked from the Groundfish Committee and the Council and the industry very hard to create a document that I thought we were going to be able to move forward today. I don't believe that it would be a valuable use of our time and for the Groundfish Committee to put too much more effort into it until after we get the GARM, and then I think we'll have the information that we need to do that we need to move forward in an expedient manner. And yesterday I heard Paul mentioned that we had a little extra money, and I think that's a good thing because we're going to need to move hard and fast to keep this as close to the timetable as possible.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, John. I'd like to know more about what legal constraints we're operating under here and what the consequences are of allowing slippage in the schedule or a postponement. I mean, a lot of people have called for it and talked about it. I'd like to know whether you can really do it without risking a secretarial action that, you know, renders this council efforts moot. So I'd like to know what we're operating under, whether it's up to this May 2009 deadline, what we have to accomplish by law, and if we don't do it because of slippage and skittle, where does that leave us?
Well, I mean, I have my opinions, but I'd rather hear from NOAA General Counsel first.
Well, I mean, nothing has changed in terms of the obligations in the regulations that require, that specify that certain default measures will go into place unless the council makes adjustments or modifications to meet the rebuilding objectives. I mean, that was what was expected. That's what's put explicitly in the regulations, that 2009 would be the year to make the necessary adjustments to keep the various stocks on track to meet the rebuilding objectives. So if nothing is done, then the default measures go into place. The agency has authority under the Madison-Stevens Act to develop and implement, you know, it's through a public process. They have the authority, first of all, to do an amendment if they wanted to through the public process that's specified. There may not be time to do that. There's also authority that has been mentioned before. Pat has mentioned it, that if she thinks the council cannot meet timelines, then she may have to consider going to an interim/emergency kind of regulations to fill in the gap between May 1st, 2009, and when the council would have the amendment completed and implemented. So that's another option that can occur. So if nothing is done by either the council or the agency, then by regulation, the default measures go into place.
Paul. Another aspect, Gene, is that NEPA requirements. If in fact the DEIS that we have now doesn't give the public a good understanding of why we are taking action, what our measures are, what they're supposed to do, the impacts of those measures. You know, we had a certain mindset when we did this DEIS. It doesn't seem like we're meeting our NEPA requirements if we send that out and it doesn't tell the picture that we know about now.
I wasn't speaking to that aspect of it. I was just speaking to the question of if we don't do it in time, what are the legal consequences? I agree that it's, you know, in my view, it's in this kind of situation, it's better to do it right than fast and short circuit the analyses, the NEPA requirements, and even the Madison-Stevens Act requirements. In the long run, I think that's the most supportable way to do it. Now, I can't speak for the agency and its decision given this new information as to exactly what the NIMS will decide to do in terms of an emergency interim kind of rule or any other action that it takes. I'm sure that we have to go back and process all of this information, the consequences, and our options as well.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I had. The other question I had is when are we going to, it was the question I asked Paul Rego this morning because I think it's the key one that can continuing forward. I don't believe, based on the information that was presented here today, that some of these stocks can be rebuilt in the remaining time, even if we shut the fishery down. I'm not sure some of them can be rebuilt in 10 years with no fishing, given the information that's here today, if this information continues to hold. We are going to need, that's the first piece of information we need. And I don't know whether we need to kind of put that in writing or, you know, request that immediately or as soon as possible, or we're just going to sit around and wait till September when it all comes out together. But basically, if it isn't coming till September, there's nothing else you can do until September as far as, you know, coming up with plans to for what's left and what has to be rebuilt. I mean, you can keep working on the sectors and that stuff, but the actual nuts and bolts stuff here of how much you get to catch and what the F rates are and whatnot, we're not going to know. So that would be the first question I'd have, and I don't know how we kind of forward that to the Science Center to find out when we could get that information.
I agree, Dave. That's a very important question. I think it's one of several that we need to get answers to prior to trying to construct new alternatives. So, Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make sure I'm absolutely clear on this. I want to follow up a little bit on what Mark said. If we do wind up going with the A13 default measures, the 18% reduction in days at sea, what are the NEPA requirements for just that alone? None. Thank you.
George.
Just to be clear, there's no new NEPA requirement because the NEPA analysis was already done through Amendment 13.
Anyone else on the council? Tom Neese?
I just wonder if Gene might explain a little further on what the rationale would be for an interim or emergency action that the service might use. Would it have to be to end overfishing, for example? And therefore, would it be limited to addressing those stocks where overfishing is occurring, or would it be a broader brush action than that? And I realize this is all speculative. I'm just wondering what the basis would be for interim action.
Right. I mean, it would depend on what the need is to be. I mean, one possibility is that the agency thinks that we have to keep on the rebuilding track that was designed in Amendment 13, Framework 42, in order to meet the statutorily required rebuilding objectives. Now that, I think, would require a broader brush action rather than just a temporary restriction on overfishing. But, I'm not sure on that. I mean, I think the agency has to examine exactly what it thinks it has to do as an interim measure, gauge how long it might be before an amendment is in place, and determine what kind of stopgap measures are necessary. Now, whether that can be done by a narrow, short-term focus on fishing mortality over 6 months or a year, I guess that's possible. I just don't know. I think it's probably too speculative. The agency, I think, would basically, in a very basic conceptual way, would be looking at making sure things don't get so bad that if we're waiting for the amendment to undermine the ability to reach the final objectives.
Anyone else on the council? Dana Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree we can't go forward. This is what we've been doing is insane. We need some accurate science to base what we're doing. But I need the clarification here. If we go into an emergency action, it may be a certain percentage, 18%, and it possibly may be. Are we not looking at possibly an industry shutdown? Or close to an industry shutdown, or numbers so severe that industry cannot operate. If we are, I think we need to have this discussion. If we are, Mr. Chairman, I think we'd ought to be discussing an industry shutdown and possibly trying to find some relief for industry if that happens. I think that's a question that this council needs to kick around it just a little bit. I throw that out there for comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, as I said in my opening remarks, I wanted to have this discussion. I'm going to go to the audience as well for some input on these topics that we're kicking around. I want to have this discussion so that the executive committee and the staff can go back to the office next week and figure out what can we do to stay true to our responsibilities to meet, the law. Given the circumstances that we're operating under, we were throwing a curveball today that, I imagine a lot of scenarios that may come at us today, but this wasn't one of them. So, a knuckleball, whatever you want to call it, But Danny, you know, we can't get there from here. So as far as a shutdown goes, we're going to do everything we can not to have to trigger something like that or a response like that from the agency or from the secretary or from whomever. Please.
Well, yes, and I support that wholeheartedly, Mr. Chairman, but I think we need to consider that if the numbers force a quasi shutdown, I'm just looking for some discussion. Should we even go further? Because this is, I'm preaching to the choir, I know, but this is extremely serious business we're talking about here. And there are people in the industry that are hanging on by a thread, and I'm not sure that they can get through this. I may be wrong, but I think it's our responsibility to have that discussion, and I'm sure you will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Dana. Jim, did you want to step in?
Yeah, one follow-up, and that is, it seems to me that if we, after the Garmin September, find some new stocks that are overfished, then according to law, you have a year to address, to come up with a fish plan to implement an end to that overfishing. So that shouldn't trigger an emergency action or an interim rule. The default would go in place, and you'd have a year to come up with a plan based on a new stock being overfished. So I don't know. I'm not a legal scholar, but I know that that's what the law says.
All right, Sally McGee.
I don't think we can do this on the fly, but we had some good discussion over the last few weeks about a more appropriate timeline and when things would happen, like public comment following the GARM rather than in advance of it, that I think was really important to be able to come up with measures that are going to be closer to making sense than if we had that discussion earlier. You know, obviously with what we heard this morning, things are different, but I think we have to have a clear timeline spelled out how we're going to get from here to there, because we have to. I don't know if we can do that this afternoon, but we have to do that quick, because, you know, the thing I think about is what happens between now and next May 1st. That was, you know, that's something that I think a lot of people have been concerned about as far as, you know, what kind of response there is in industry to the, you know, to pending significant cutbacks in advance of those cuts going into place, that if we're delaying even further, then I think we're going to be encouraging a kind of fishing activity that isn't going to help in the long run at all, and probably not in the short run either. So I would hate to see us actually to sit on our hands until September. I understand there are major questions that we've all been waiting for a long time to get the answer to in the GARM, but to sit for 3 months is not acceptable. You know, there are other measures that can be developed here. You know, we're inching our way closer and closer to May 1st, 2010. And if we want to have some of the measures in place to mitigate the economic impacts, namely the possibility for sectors, we need to be further developing those measures. And, you know, why not keep working on that now so that people can actually see some kind of light at the end of the tunnel? Otherwise, we're just going to be pushing people even further into desperate measures. So, again, I would hope that we can be as clear as possible either by the end of today or very soon after the end of this meeting in the next week, what the timeline is and how we're actually going to get to where we need to go.
I agree that we need to have a timeline fashioned quickly, but I'm not sure we're going to get it today, simply because I think we need input from people that aren't even in the room. We can talk about the sequence of events that should happen, but the actual timing, I think, will be a little difficult. And there's been several comments about, well, I don't want the council sitting on its hands till the GARM. I hope no one took my comments to suggest that's what we were going to do. I do believe there are elements of this amendment, specifically the sector elements, that we can go back to and continue to refine through the committee. And I know I think there's some motions that are coming forward today out of the committee meeting that address those issues. I had Frank Blount.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hoping that we would meet the deadlines here. There's no way that I think we can go forward. But I think the committee's put a lot of work into it. We do have a document here. We have five options, or there's four in there, maybe five after today. I don't foresee the options changing that much between now and the end. The actual measures in those options will definitely change. But I think we move forward with what we have. I think we keep working on what there's not going to be a lot of change. I mean, we have one option is a day at sea cut. I'm not sure the day at sea cut is going to change that much with the information we got today. The other one is for closed areas. That probably they'll change because there are going to be different closed areas that we want to see change. We have one for differential counting. That may or may not change based on the stocks that are in trouble now. We have another option that will be coming forward today, which was for trip limits. I don't foresee that one changing other than the actual numbers for what the trip limit would be. That's if that gets approved today. So I don't think the basic five options that we have are going to change all that much. I think the work is there, and that's what we move forward with. The sectors I think we keep working on. I think when we get to the end, it's just a matter of plugging in the numbers into those five options. So I would hate to see us throw those out or try and come up with a whole bunch of new ones. We've had, we can say we've been working on this for a year and a half, but the groundfish plant we've been working on for the last 20 years, and there aren't that many options out there. We know what they are. We know we may not like the outcome of them, but somewhere in one of those five is where we're going to be and what we have to move forward with. So I hope we proceed that way. Thank you.
Gene.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to Jimmy Odlin's comment a minute ago just to clarify my earlier comments. If a stock that has not been identified previously as overfished is now being identified as overfished, then the timeline under the Madison-Stevens Act, which gives the council opportunity to respond and develop an amendment, kicks in. And I'm not suggesting that the agency would be interested in shortening or trumping that process by doing an interim rule. But for stocks that have already been identified that are still overfished and where rebuilding objectives might be undermined, then that's where the agency has to decide whether it should take some sort of unilateral action or not as a stopgap measure or in the absence of timely council action.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to follow up on Frank's comment. While I agree with just about everything he said, I think that a number of the effort control alternatives were in fact crafted, and the analysis was done on those, thinking that white hake was driving the issue. And since we've found that that's not the case, I think that a number of those effort control measures need to be re-looked at before we essentially put them into the document. I think Frank's correct in that we are probably going to have the same kinds of things, whether it's looking at days at sea reductions or closed areas or gear restricted areas. But I think in terms of getting specific language, I think we probably need to wait on those. And we do have a bunch of things that are really focused on the sectors and in the recreational fishery that we can go ahead with and continue to develop this Amendment 16 document.
Dr. Pierce.
At this point in time, we're looking in the rear view mirror relative to stock status. That was made very clear to us by Paul this morning. It's data through 06. I'm not sure whether it's the beginning of 06 or through the end of 06, but anyways, it's It's a situation that apparently existed a few years ago, and it doesn't reflect what happened under Framework 42, recognizing that Framework 42 hasn't been in place that long. But Framework 42 was a significant framework that was projected to have some rather dramatic impacts on mortality and on rebuilding. We worked hard to get it done, and of course it was implemented. And now the fishermen are living under the restrictions of Framework 42. I'm assuming that once we get to the GARM, with 07 data being looked at, I think Paul said, that might give us some additional insights into, at least some insights into impacts of Framework 42. So right now we're looking in the rearview mirror. Now the defaults, I do agree with Frank that, well, the default will kick in. If nothing significant changes as a consequence of the GARM, then the triggers that would be pulled to prevent an 18% cut in days at sea, well, they're not going to be pulled. We're going to have an 18% cut in days at sea, which is a significant cut that's bound to have a dramatic impact on the industry, on fishing mortality, and will also impact our rebuilding. That is, we should be more on track than we otherwise would be. But again, all remains to be seen after the GARM is through. But frankly, I think the biggest consideration that we're going to have relative to success or failure and how this amendment is actually going to be designed in its final form is the MSRA, the National Standard Number 1 guidelines, and what we are going to be required to do by the National Marine Fisheries Service relative to National Standard Number 1. As I said yesterday, I think, and I certainly have said this at previous Groundfish Committee meetings, I hope that when all is said and done, the National Standard Number 1 guidelines are consistent with congressional intent, and that the guidelines don't put us in a position where we are straitjacketed, and we have very little option, if any option, but to shut the industry down, and not just the groundfish fisheries, but other industries, other fisheries that will be taking groundfish as a bycatch, and this cuts across councils. This gets into the middle and to council as well. So, again, I support the delay, the development of a new timeline, with an understanding that significant actions will occur through the default, without question, and I'm hopeful that Framework 42 has indeed accomplished much of what we tried to do, and that is to dramatically cut mortality on the stocks. We'll see what happens once the GARM is completed.
Dave Gatham.
Yeah. What happens to Framework 42 on May 1st, 2009? Does that expire? Okay, so that'll stay in effect. We don't have to do anything to keep it in effect. And then we'll have the 18% cut on top of that. Is that correct?
George?
There is at least one thing that would expire. The pilot Haddock SAP program would expire, unless it were extended after May 1.
Okay. I'd just like to be absolutely sure what anything that we need to know about what would expire if we have to take action here relatively quickly to either keep it from happening or whatever. I was actually under the impression that the whole thing ended May 1st, 2009, and that all that would happen is you get an 18% cut in days, but you return to one-to-one counting. So I didn't think that was really appropriate, I mean, if given the situation.
Dave, that's another one of the questions that I was talking about. You asked the question about can we rebuild in 10 years, and the question you just asked there, there's a list of questions that we need to get clarity on. Tom Neese, did you want to address that point? George got it. Okay, anyone else in the council before I go to the audience? Okay, Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council, Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. We think the council is moving down a sensible path now with changing the schedule to implement the measures when we know exactly what we need to do. I would agree with the comments that council members have made regarding what you do in the interim in terms of continuing work on sectors. I think we're almost where we need to be on those. I don't think there's a lot of work there, but we could also possibly use that time to develop an ITQ proposal. With respect to possible interim action by the agency, it's not clear to me what that would be based on, since they still won't have any information until the GARM is complete. But I wanted to follow up somewhat on what Dave Gaethel had just asked about what expires, and to suggest that if there isn't, I mean, we could have a agency action to do something positive, which would be to reauthorize the U.S.-Canada SAP to make the 18-inch haddock continue, and possibly even to remove the conservation tax on the Days at Sea transfer program. So I would suggest that maybe that's something that the council would recommend to the agency, that they take action in order to make those positive changes that could be implemented by May 2009. Thank you.
Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glenn Delaney, Northeast Seafood Coalition. It's clear where things need to go and where they're headed. It's a question, really, of the mechanics and how to get there. Just a thought for some discussion, if you're interested, you know, trying to think through how to deal with the automatic defaults that would kick in and potentially agency interim slash emergency action, and, you know, how to get from here to there. The provision that's driving your 2009 requirement has a lot less to do with the Magnuson Act than it does to do with what's in Amendment 13, and that's just simply a provision that says that your midterm adjustment shall occur in 2009, and that could be changed by Amendment 16. You could change your midterm adjustment in the rebuilding plans under Amendment 13 to 2010, and thereby put into synchrony with the establishment of sectors. You would meet your Magnuson requirements to have ACLs and AMs in place in 2010. You'd have ended overfishing according to Magnuson Act requirements. So essentially everything would come together in the year that you need to do it. And just something to think about. I mean, that would potentially avoid the default issue. You could decide then what would go into place in 2009, then have Amendment 13 tell you what goes into place in 2009. The agency, in my humble opinion, would not have the basis for an interim rule, because there wouldn't be the need to act under that emergency action or Magnuson rebuilding requirements. So think about that, that potentially that's something Amendment 16 could do, is just change the interim adjustment, or the, what's called the midterm adjustment in Amendment 13 from 2009 to 2010. And what the industry needs is a tool to deal with those cuts that are coming. I mean, as I think someone and several of you said, the cuts are coming one way or the other. It's a question of whether the industry will have a tool available to it to deal with it. And that was the idea behind sectors. And once those became separated in the schedule, we were left with the reality of having to deal with Days at Sea management in 2009. Well, this would give you the opportunity to take those cuts at the same time as implementing something like sectors, so the industry would have some way to deal with those reductions when they come. And those reductions could be based on this year's GARM. So hopefully I explained that somewhat clearly, but that's just an idea that came to mind that might give you a lot of flexibility and control over how to get from here to there that you're talking about. Thanks.
George.
To that point, and I just want to remind everybody that the rebuilding programs and the time frames are already in place, and any delay in how long it takes us to make whatever mortality changes are necessary to meet the objectives is potentially going to mean we're deeper into those rebuilding periods and the more onerous those measures might have to be.
Sean?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Sean Guillen with the representing the Fisheries Survival Fund. I just wanted to the question that Mr. Gaethel had raised earlier and Gene had touched on regarding the sort of vague question of what happens when you've reassessed your management reference points and find out that it's biologically impossible to meet the meet a rebuilding schedule that's already been developed in law or in an amendment. I think as correctly stated earlier, the law doesn't directly speak to it. It just says when the agency says something is overfished, the council has, sorry, Jim, it's 2 years now. That's the new change in the law. 2 years to come up with a plan to rebuild. But it doesn't say what happens, if you've done that once and now you've got some new numbers and you have new information. As you read down the statute, it says when you're specifying a rebuilding period, you should look at the status and biology of stocks, needs of fishing communities, so on and so forth. So when you have new biological information and, biology is new information is sort of trumped what you've known before, then, obviously there's a question that exists that can't be directly answered by the Act. And generally in those cases, the agency is, has the discretion to interpret the law. Given that, we're talking about big cuts, in some cases some of these, we're pretty far off from where we thought we might have to get by the end of the rebuilding periods, and you're going to be tasking folks to develop rebuilding strategies, it would probably behoove the council to get, to ask the agency for a legal opinion. Can we reset the clocks? What would guide that determination? And have that information, as to how the agency would use its discretion in a case like this, because I think it would help the management aspects as you move forward. Thanks.
Phil Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the time. Sitting here listening, and probably be no surprise to you, it's getting very confusing. But as I sit here listening to the different options and stuff, I start to feel like the guy who was in charge of the deck chairs on the Titanic. That's about where we are. When I sit here and look, I wrote this stuff down before I got to the meeting this morning, so I lose a little wind with this, but we got 25 years of management under our belt here in Groundfish. I think you got 10 to 12 years, Tom probably correct me, of quota management. We have 13 years plus nowadays at sea management, somewhere along them lines there. And now, up until this morning, we was looking at this serious reduction. It'd be one question that jumped out at me, and maybe Tom could do it for me. If you took a 70% reduction, which is the one alternative in days at sea, that's a 70% reduction from where we are now, from 42. What would that reduction be in percentage-wise from when we allocated days in 94? It would be just an interesting number to look at, to see where we actually got to just under the days at sea. Hmm? We'd be at 5%. It wouldn't be a 5% reduction.
Yes,
all right. I could look at the backside of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that just tells me where we are. And that kind of goes to where I'm going here. The other thing I think needs to be mentioned is where we are now with the discussion of this timeline and where we got to be by the goal that's there. And we sat around here 5 years ago, and by and large, we agreed to a plan with a, what was it, adaptive rebuilding strategy on some stocks, which went into Amendment 13. We kicked stuff around this way, that way. So end of the day, what we took was play now and pay later. Well, late is today. We got there. And in my mind, the bill just came due. I've never been one to walk away from bills. So I'd ask the council, when they start into this next round or whichever way you plan on going here, to consider another alternative. And let's close the fishery for the remaining rebuilding time frame that 13 has left, 5 years, I think it is, from the May 1st line. Close the fishery, take the 5 years, try and build something that works. Go with an ITQ, go with your points, go with area management, take a few years to get something built that when a fishery does come back, you got something that works that you can rock and load with. I know it sounds a little drastic, but this is pretty drastic stuff. A 70% reduction and a 100% reduction, the only jobs that are saved there are ashore. They're not in the industry. I mean, but this is a pretty serious mess here. I don't see the reality is there is no difference, 70% reduction, 50% reduction, or 100% reduction. It's just a matter of how much time one guy lasts over the other guy. That's basically where you're heading for here. If you stay with that size reduction, one of the consequences of that is you'll turn this fishery over to the selected few who have the wherewithal to stay within it for a few years or have something else to subside, whatever. So you're getting very selective in where this fishery is going to end up, because you're putting it, people are going to go out one by one by one by one. That's how it's going to go. Just like bowling pins, people are going to go down step after step. There'll be some people that can stick around, you know, no doubt, and that's who you'll be turning the fishery over to. And I don't think that's the right way to go about this. One of the bigger problems you have is the whole management strategy that we've worked under for all these years. When I was a kid and all through history of this industry, when something went down, you shifted. You went to something else to go fish on. You know, if you were a ground fisherman, you went lobstering, you went and did this. Well, through the management strategies of the service, and not only this council, but mostly every council, everything is limited entry, so you can't go from here to there like you used to. When times are tough, you can't jump out of this one and get into that one, because them doors are all closed on us. That's part of where we are. So, you know, the effects of these alternatives will have on the 70% stuff. When you're considering stuff, consider what it's going to do to the leasing program, because it's going to drive that like a spinning top. I mean, that'll go, whatever the effects are of differential counting, will go the other way, and then it'll get to a certain point, it's going to go back the other way. It's going to be pretty hard to figure, I would think. I say close it because I consider going to zero A days and using the B day program for the fisheries that are healthy and maintain something. But in my opinion, the B-Day program, as it worked on yellowtails and skates and a few other spots, is just going to create another problem that we'll have to address at that point. So I can kick that aside and say just close it. If you close the fishery, for once the industry will know where the hell it is. That's really got a good point. It will allow the industry and the state to go to Congress and hope for some kind of, you know, compensation or whatever can be done to address it. It would give the council quite a bit of time to get the house in order, come up with, like I said, you had a handful of different management strategies that were in front of you. I mean, you can look back now, it's 25 years, this is where we are. What we're using didn't work. Didn't work in quotas, didn't work in days at sea. So take a few years, get some information together and see what you can come up with. When the fishery comes back, we reach a milestone after 5 years or so. If we're at a point where you can go back to fishing, you'll have something, you can have something in place that you can load. Here you go. To me, it's going to be a devastation to the industry. Yeah, 70% causes the same devastation. I don't care how you look at it. It's going to be terrible on the markets. It's going to be terrible on the infrastructure. Still, there's no difference that I can see between them. But taking the cuts and hearing what I heard this morning, we can't get there from here, just like you said, John. We try to hear, there, whatever. I mean, we've kicked these chairs all over the deck and they don't fit. So I'm asking that you just give it some serious consideration. I know it sounds like I lost my friggin' mind, but it ain't the first time. Then I had a couple other issues, and I don't know if you want to touch on them now or later. This is just to this. But I would ask that the council, in the meantime, industry, I think you'd find mostly agreement if they get a letter to the service saying that the Yellowtail trip limit at this point in time should drop to like 2,500 instead of the 5,000 rat. The fish are in terrible quality. The prices are real low, just like we had a couple of years ago with the SAP. I think most of the industry would be in agreement to postpone the trip, lower the trip limit until we can get some value out of them, then raise the trip limit. I urge a few people that are behind us there to agree to step up to it. And just one comment, the comment period, I think, on the Eliminator net was out. I think it expired yesterday or whatever, but I have worked with service a little bit, and we tried to come up with the wording for the regulation, and then when the proposed rule comes out, I was slightly less than happy. The wording in that proposed rule states the exact measurement of the mesh, and then a rope net, that doesn't happen. The rope, because it's 8 foot, is one mesh will slide, one mesh will go this way, one mesh will go that way. I had suggested two meshes have to be 15 foot, not the exact measurement that the net was built to, because of the configuration of the net, that's all going to change. One mesh might slip 3-4 inches, another mesh will gain 3 inches. That's what happens with rope. They change as they conform. What's the harm in this? You know, I mean, what are you going to protect? It's an 8-foot mesh. 15-foot yellowtails ain't that big a thing. You know, so this is what the sensibility of this thing, you know. We sent comments in on it, and I would hope that the council could just, it doesn't have to be a specific mesh. When they roll it off the drum and they look and the mesh is bigger than they are, that's pretty much good enough. Thank you, sir.
John Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Williamson for Ocean Conservancy. We fully expect that the statutory requirements will be met on May 1st, 2009, and that responsibility now clearly falls to the service to carry out. We also would just like to remind people that the Amendment 13 was the remedy for, and by extension, the five-year rebuilding adjustment was the remedy for a court order from 2002. And so that's really what is at stake and is driving the responsibility that the service now shoulders. However, we would urge this council to continue to work through the summer on the set of measures that you have to develop. I agree with Frank Blount that the information that you received this morning is merely a shift in emphasis, that you have a set of potential tools now that have been developed and they need to just be adapted to new information that you've got, the experience of development, the mortality goals for Framework 42 are still fresh in the committee and the PDT's experience, and that that information can be applied to help scale the set of measures that you've got to develop over and can develop over the summer, so that the sooner that this amendment can get out the door on top of an interim action that we're anticipating, the sooner then that the council can take control back for the groundfish plan in 2009. And the other set of measures that you need to develop in this amendment, I would remind you, is that are not complete are the accountability measures and the and a process for applying ACL that it still is not quite fully developed. So that all those things can be fleshed out over the summer, and we're anticipating there's a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Rich Canaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Council. Rich Canaster, Whalen City Seafood Display Auction and the Boston Seafood Display Auction. I'm very optimistic, you know. You know, we really have to take a look at what 42 is doing, Framework 42. I can attest from at least my computer system that I have, which I think works fairly well, that Georgia Bank flounder is a 70% down from 2006. You people are looking for a 30% reduction. We're down 70%. Without seeing 2007 figures, I think my figures are 2007. You're going off of 2006. And I think you're going to see a drastic reduction in mortality. I have seen it through the auction system. The auction systems have seen it. But anyway, by postponing this, you'll be helping out the industry, most definitely. And I agree that that 18% default was definitely going to kill the industry. I would wait until we have tools that we could work with, like Glenn Delaney spoke about sectors. But I just want to give you a synopsis of what's happening or what happened. You know, with optimal yield, we never really speak about it. We speak about overfishing, the codfish, the yellowtail, but we never speak about Magnuson's Act that protects fishermen or helps out the industry. We always speak about protecting the fish, which is good. But we have to speak about protecting the industry. The TAC report summary for 2007 fishing reports that only 42% of Georgia Bank's cod TAC was caught. 30% of Gulf of Maine haddock, 4% of Georgia Bank's haddock. 43% redfish, 83% whitehake, 49% Georgia Bank winter flounders, and 20% witch flounder. It's definitely a system that's not working on optimal yield. The next thing we can see is that nymphs will probably get sued. You'll probably get sued, and I have to leave saying, so what? People get sued every day, so what? You people are saving an industry. Let them sue, because it's just not making any sense.
Vito J.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome back. As the chairman, your vice chairman did a good job during your absence. Mr. Chairman, I wasn't going to speak because I spoke this morning and I listened to Senator Collins' letter to the council, and it gave me some hope. But, Mr. Chairman, I have to speak after listening to Phil Rule, excuse me. He did a good job. He spoke what's in his heart. He's been a good advocate for the fishing industry, but I disagree on one thing about shutting down the industry. If you shut down the industry for 5 years, I think Phil forgot to think about the infrastructure that would be lost and never to come back. I looked out yesterday while I was at the whole name of it, the aquarium there, and I seen all these condos built on the waterfront. It seems to be happening more and more often. And if you ever shut down the industry for 5 years, there would never be a place for a fish auction, an ice house, any net lofts or anything else that would be along the waterfront, fueling along the waterfront. Yeah, some of these things can go inland, but for the most part, there'd be less dockage or no dockage. People stop and forgot, they stop thinking and forgot that pretty hard to put a commercial fishing vessel next to a sports marina. Pretty hard to put a commercial fishing dock next to condominiums because although to me the odor is not offensive, it is offensive to people with their nets and what they do for a living. The large noise, and I mean the very loud noise sometimes of a big diesel starting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to go fishing. They're just very hard to coexist with people that buy waterfront property. Mr. Chairman, I'm hoping that Senator Snow's staff person is still in the audience and has listened to everything. I heard people say that the light at the end of the tunnel, the only light I see at the end of the tunnel is a red light, even though my heart and soul is going to be with this council again. And I don't need to blow smoke up anybody's anything, but I will say that your leadership as chairman has been very impressive to me and others. I agree on most everything you do, most, not all. There's a few places we disagree, but I disagree with my wife for 37 years, so I'm still there, you know? And she's here somewhere. I don't know. She might have took off. Who knows? But I think listening to some of the counselors speaking, trying to resolve this program right now and trying to figure some ideas, I think taking a little time out, I'm not saying stop, I'm saying a time out to try to reevaluate because time is of the essence, yes, but time is on your side in one way because that's all you have. Because on the course we're going at $4.50 for fuel per gallon to a vessel, it's going to be very difficult to make it. If there's a reduction of 18% or 20% or 30%, likely he won't make it. I'm a realist. What we did years ago, Mr. Chairman, is to have a boat buyback program of $30 million in New England that helped get rid of some of the old vessels, helped get rid of some of the captains that weren't real good managers. But today what you have is the cream of the crop. You have the very best left. And they're starting to get out. I'm starting to see the boats disappear. I'll leave it like that again. I'm starting to see crews disintegrate, deteriorate. We heard from the Coast Guard the other day talk about vessels sinking at the dock. That has started again, too, because they cannot put money into the old vessels. There have been very few replacements. And people cannot maintain the vessels that they did years ago. It's too high. The economics are killing us. With more restrictions, we are doomed. I'm hoping that between working with our federal people, our legislators, this New England Council, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the people that sit in this audience who come up and speak like I am today, can assist you in somehow. This is a tall task. Maybe people feel that with sectors and IFQs or something, what are you going to have less? A token fishing industry? If that's what you want, you're headed that way. If that's the ultimate goal, and I don't believe it is, of the council, listening to the people that sit on this council, I don't believe it was their request to have that. But you would lose many of the processes you have that have invested millions of dollars. You would lose the way of life. You would lose a lot more. I've been windy enough and let somebody else speak, but I appreciate the opportunity and other people that come, they appreciate the opportunity. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
The bill in the back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Gerenzer. I think one thing we've learned over the past several years is that, as is, fishery management doesn't work. It hasn't been working under its present form, and in the future it's not going to work either unless we make some fundamental changes. Now, looking back, in the early 90s, we had a fleet that consisted of a decent number of 135-foot boats, a lot of 70- to 90-foot boats, many localized fleets of 40 to 55-foot boats from Lubeck all the way down to Point Judith. The boats could fish with a much smaller mesh. Many days a year they could figure out how to stay out, didn't have trip limits, could fish basically wherever they wanted. And this is just to put things in perspective. Now today, 135-footers are all gone. The 70 to 90-foot boats are now considered the big boats. We've lost many of our localized fleets. I mean, try and find fishing boats in Stonington or a lot of the small ports in Maine nowadays. There's just those fleets, if they haven't disappeared, they're just one or two boats left. On top of that, we have, as you all know, mesh sizes, about 40,000 square miles of seasonal and year-round closures, trip limits, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, the ability to fish, or the fishing power of New England, has been reduced drastically. I could make a good case that it's somewhere between a quarter and a fifth of what it was, and maybe even smaller. And yet, we're here, and we walked up to the doorstep this week of taking what we have now and cutting it by another 70%, which basically would have made everybody economically unviable. And why? Why is fisheries management failing? Well, I put a little bit of thought into it, and I have three reasons, and I have some suggestions on how to get out of it. The first involves what I call fisheries politics, because what passes for developing a management plan usually contains an element of competition for the resource or allocation or fishing rights. And when that happens, you tend to deflect necessary effort reductions because you're fighting over the right to fish, and sometimes you're not cutting where you should. And it's the political aspect of this. And so it tends to delay rebuilding times. Next is fisheries law. And this is a long-term thing, but the mindset has to change. I think, as written, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act is in many ways an excellent piece of legislation. But it fails in a couple of key points. First, because it depends upon the use of biological reference points. And biological reference points are kind of an artificial construct. Fish stocks don't stay at a reference point. Their populations rise and fall naturally, and especially in a multi-species fishery, because the stocks, as one stock, are competing with each other for food, and they may and are even preying upon each other. So we're trying to maintain all our stocks at these BRPs, and to have them all at the right BRT is impossible. It'll never happen. And so we've got this impossible situation to manage to, and then we add the words "as soon as possible" to that when we have to return stocks to a BRP, and we're basically set up to fail. Finally, fishery science. I think over time the population tracking and analysis that Northeast Fishery Science Center does is the best in the world. But it was never designed to be a dynamic management tool. And the stock assessments come way too slow for us to have any real value in using. This is in part because, you know, it was never designed, in part because we don't have the budgets at the Science Center to take care of this. So you add these three situations together, you got a management plan fueled by obsolete data and driven by a law that sets impossible targets and strict deadlines, and it brings the fishery down a very rough road. So from a political perspective, we need less pressure from political sources as to the direction of management and more support financially for infrastructure so that we can keep this, if we're actually interested in keeping a fishery, and I'll get to that in a minute. We need support for that. We need support for monitoring, and most importantly, the Science Center has to be better funded. And I know there's some folks from D.C. in the audience, so I hope they're hearing that. Secondly, and again, this is not something the council can deal with, but we have to start building in our minds right now that the law needs to be changed. You know, we need to be allowed to manage stocks in the multi-species fishery with the legal recognition that BRPs are an artificial construct and do not correctly describe how given fish stocks should look, stocks naturally rise and fall, and all the legal mandates in the world aren't going to change that. And finally, most important is the science. Best available science is a poor substitute for correct and useful science. We need to be able to get landings data on Monday updated from the previous Friday, not from several months ago. We need to be able to sample spawn enclosures in real time so we don't close or open an area too early. I'm not asking too much here. I can routinely access this kind of information from some friends at the DFO in Halifax, and I'm not even Canadian. So we also need to be able to assess our stocks in a more timely manner. Ocean and dockside survey data and logbook data take way too long to make it through our system. You know, how is it that Magnuson mandates that we have to rebuild our stocks as quickly as possible, but the best available science arrives whenever it damn well pleases? Unless we change our mindset here about the way science is delivered, we're always going to be stuck and managing poorly. And speaking of mindsets, at the Groundfish Advisory Panel last week, I asked the Groundfish Committee Chair to explain the regional administrator's advice on what we had to do, the task, because I'd overheard him saying something and I wanted to get it clear. And he said, well, the way to think of it is like this. Either you perform surgery on yourself with a jackknife, or I'll do it with a hammer. And that was his assessment of what was coming out of the regional office. Now, originally I thought, well, this kind of thinking indicates a disdain for the patient, but someone suggested to me it might not be that we're the patient, we're considered the disease as the fishery, and we have to be removed from the situation. It might be useful to recognize that the point of surgery is not to do the operation, but to save the patient. And finally, there's also an interest in moving towards catch shares in the form of sectors which you won't get started on right away, but you know, as an interim step, and I know it's oversimplified the way I'm putting it, but we suggested tying trip limits to a 24-hour day at sea and vice versa, and that will sort of automatically distribute shares of the catch and be a nice interim step in getting towards that you can use to get into sectors with. I think that, you know, I don't recommend that the council stop working because you haven't got anything to work with, because now everything you've done has to be thrown out the window. I think it's important to find something like sectors and this sort of thing to work on, because I don't want to see the regional administrator just take action unilaterally. I think that we can do a nice job managing this, but we have to demand some changes and get some help changing this. But we're stuck, and until we fix the science, we're always managing in the dark. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Mr. Levy.
Gary Libby, Mid-Coast Fishermen's Association, Port Clyde, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak. The thing I wanted to address was the total shutdown and the infrastructure. I think if we shut down the industry for 5 years, it may be good for the fish, but it would be terrible for markets and fishermen, because we would go the way the shrimp fishery did in Maine, and we're still trying to rebuild from a 25-day season. And without product, worldwide markets go other places, and we lose everything. And even if we have an ocean full of fish, we're still not going to be have any value, because we're not going to be able to move the stuff if we don't have a market. And thanks for the time.
Okay, back to the council. I'd like to wrap up this discussion over the next 5 or 10 minutes, and then take a very brief break, and then go into the Groundfish Committee report. Dr. Pierce.
Well, I stand to be guided by what you would like to do, Mr. Chairman. I was prepared to make a motion that's related to this discussion and what the council would like to do, or perhaps would like to do with this amendment. I'll make the motion and see what the response would be. I would move the council develop a new timeline for development and implementation of Amendment 16. To, number one, use new and revised biological reference points, and GARM stock status information as the basis for the amendment. Number two, provide needed time for the council to respond to and apply National Standard Number One guidelines still under development. And three, afford adequate time for public comment on resulting amendment alternatives and impact analysis.
There's a second. Seconded by Doug Grout. Discussion? Jim Odlin.
Just a question on what does needed time mean? I mean, I need to just flush that out. Needed, how much time do we need? And I mean, I have my own idea, but I think that's a little ambiguous. If we could try to glean in on what at least what you're thinking on that needed time. I mean,
yeah, regarding the timeline, the new timeline.
In other words, you're saying provide the needed time. I see. Provide the needed time for the council to respond and to apply the national standards. Mm-hmm. In other words, what does that mean? In reality, that's fine for the motion, but yeah, you're talking. We need to get national standard one. I think it's out now today, right? Proposed rules today. So we'll respond. You're asking the council to respond to the proposed rule. Then we need to see the final rule and then apply that to the job we need to do going forward. Is that how I read that motion?
Well, as it stands right now, we don't have anything in hand. We might have proposed rules, but we don't have final rules. And I would like to be guided by the final National Standard Number One guidelines. I'm assuming that certainly by the fall, we would be in a position to have those guidelines in hand, and we would then be able to use them to craft the amendment. That's what I mean by needed time. We just don't have them now. And regarding the new timeline, my intent is to essentially follow the guidance offered up by the chair at the beginning of these discussions, which is subject to his suggestion that the executive committee, I suppose, staff executive committee, work on a new timeline that could then be presented to the council, something that would be realistic and sensitive to these particular issues.
George?
We have no way of knowing when the final National Standard 1 guidelines are going to be out, and it's probably largely beyond our control. There's going to be a fairly lengthy comment period. We're also going to be in a transition period for administrations, and it's very likely we're going to get many, many comments. So to me, this just provides the opportunity to delay this amendment unnecessarily. So I would encourage you, you've got the proposed rule, or we'll very shortly have the proposed rule. You're going to have a presentation on the National Standard Guidelines tomorrow. You're going to get certainly the essence, and frankly, the councils have heard the essence for quite some time. I don't think you're going to find anything there that's going to provide you the kind of relief you're hoping for this fishery. So I would urge you to proceed as quickly as possible, incorporating the best available science as soon as it's available, and take this thing to completion and not find ways to just put it off.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Dr. Pierce's sentiment completely, but I can't support the motion as it's written for one reason, is the one that George brought out. And the other thing is that I can't see it right now. It says the council develop a new timeline. That would imply that we won't have a timeline until the next council meeting, and I don't find that acceptable either. I think it would have to go along with some other mechanism. I don't know exactly how to do it, but I'm not willing to wait until the next council meeting to have a new timeline. Thank you.
Sally.
Yep, I completely agree with the previous two commenters. I can't support this motion with what was previously numbered item number two, with regard to response to a presumably final version of the National Standard 1 guidelines. That's incomprehensible how long that would potentially take. Secondly, I would suggest, as far as the previous comment, develop a new timeline immediately. I would interpret that to mean that if this went forward, then over the course of the next several days, that a new timeline would be developed that the council and the Groundfish Committee would be following to get as close as possible to implementing Amendment 16, as close as possible to May 1st, 2009.
Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like everyone else, I'd like to see the National Standard 1 guidelines out tomorrow, but I don't think that we should be holding up what we're going to do on this for that. So, and like the previous commenters, if we modified or got rid of Section 2, I would be much more supportive of this. And so to Dave Preble's comment, I'd like to see this timeline developed as soon as possible.
Dave?
I would think that the timeline could be presented to us before we leave the meeting tomorrow. Why not? So this motion would be all right as worded relative to the council developing a new timeline. We get it tomorrow. Regarding the National Standard Number 1 guidelines, my preference is to leave it in. However, I don't mind striking it out if it will enable the full council to vote this through. However, I will point out that I'm disturbed by what George just said, that we're not going to like the proposed guidelines. My agency offered up extensive comment on the proposed National Standard Number 1 guidelines. I'm hopeful that some of those comments were taken to heart and that there would be some favorable reaction to the points that we made. I know I'm Pollyanna and naive, but nevertheless, George is essentially telling us right now that indeed we will be in a straitjacket. And I'm going to assume, therefore, that the straitjacket may eventually lead us to shut down the entire industry. I hope that's not the case. Time will tell, I suppose, once the discussion occurs tomorrow and ensuing discussions after that. So with that said, if there's no objection, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't mind removing the second item from the list.
Seconder agree. Without objection. Okay, please strike number two. As I said in my opening remarks, my back of the envelope timeline, and I need to fill in all the issues, but I'm thinking we're targeting the February council meeting. I think it's a 4 or 5 month extension to develop. And if you'd like, I can work with the committee chair and staff to tonight and tomorrow to try to sketch out a tentative timeline, if that would make the council more comfortable before we leave tomorrow. Okay. Anything further on the motion? Mark?
Given what you just said, how far past May 2009 would we be in terms of measures being implemented?
My guess would be August, September is when you would see those probably become effective.
Well, follow up. I understand the need to do this, but I think you're going to be inviting an action by the service. I don't think you can count on just some default measures plopping into place. If the center comes to the conclusion that productivity in this system has been impaired by fishing, by fishing, and that further remaining productivity is at risk for continued fishing, I think you could have something quite serious happen here. And I'm very concerned about sending that message out now that this has to be delayed until a good component of the fishing year has gone on. But that's my view on it.
Council members? Mike Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in favor of this. I think if we're going to do it, we might as well take our time and do it right. It seems like people think if we put this off that we're going to go back fishing 100 days or 200 days a year. I mean, we have differential counting. Fuel's 450. We're not just going to run out there and fish whole hog to throw the stuff over. I mean, you know, Framework 42, I think, addressed a lot of these problems. And once that data comes about, we'll find out that the reductions needed aren't as severe, hopefully, as that we presented this morning. Thanks.
Sally.
Okay, so to be clear, then, the intent would be that this timeline is going to be developed this afternoon, this evening, and we'll talk about it again tomorrow, and then there'll be another vote on it tomorrow. Is that correct?
I was going to say, you know, what more do you really need a developed timeline? What we're looking at, back of the envelope, is February. We vote out the final document in February. We need 4 months to do a new DEIS, which is, you know, well underway, hold some public hearings, and then come to a final vote in February, which is 4 months different. We were planning on October. So that's back of the envelope. Now, there may be many changes between now and then, but, that's what we're planning on now.
I'm not sure how many PDT meetings or how many committee meetings we'll need to have. I've heard it from enough people in the council and from the audience that they want the council to continue working on the sector elements and elements like that that are in the document between now and GARM. I think that was pretty clear from the comments. So the timeline would contain that. Anything further? You ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Eleven. Opposed? One. Abstentions? Three. Abstain. Motion carries 11-1 with three abstentions. Take a 10-minute break. Dave Preble.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is really for George, if that's okay. George, we've gone through quite a lot here in putting together our proposals. And what I'm concerned with and what I was getting at with my question before is just what course the agency would take. And that doesn't seem to be clear at this point as to whether it would be going to the default measures or actually doing a secretarial action. And what I would like to strongly urge and ask, actually, is if it goes to a secretarial action, we have already put in place in the document we've been working on a number of mitigating factors And I want to make sure that these would be taken into consideration under advisement. We've done things like discard monitoring and stuff like that. If some of this stuff could be would be used by the agency in mitigating some of the devastation to the industry in the sectorial action.
Yes. Frankly, I don't know what the action the agency is going to take. We're going to consider our options just as the council is. And certainly something we would consider is various types of secretarial actions given the circumstances. But yes, we would look at if there were measures that would minimize impacts of whatever we felt we had to do, we would certainly consider them as well.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's somewhat reassuring, I guess.
Okay, before we get into the committee motions, is there anything else the council wants to discuss before we get through the committee's work? Sally?
Yeah, while it's relatively fresh in people's minds, and now that it seems pretty clear that we have some time to pay attention to one issue that National Marine Fisheries Service has raised many times in the context of Amendment 16 is that the monitoring provisions that are in there to date are insufficient. And I would suggest that the Groundfish Committee needs to be focusing on the monitoring provisions and take some time over the next few months to actually flesh those out. And so I have a motion to that effect. I would move to direct the Groundfish Committee to consider inclusion of options for catch monitoring as described in the two reports submitted by the council by Archipelago in April and June of 2008. To the council.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion? Mark?
I thought we heard today, and I think Jim's not here, I thought there was some questioning from Jim for the presenter that there was some more feedback needed to take place and consideration of comments on some of the information in those reports that perhaps was in dispute with the service, but maybe I didn't fully. So I'm wondering if this is premature to draw upon those reports at this time. That's all I'm wondering.
George.
I think it's our plan, and with the center, to review those reports, particularly the second one that we just received, and provide comments from our perspective on the contents of those reports.
And if this motion were to pass, you could convey those. You could convey your findings or your feelings on the reports to the council, and we'd make sure they get to the committee?
Yes.
Okay. Dave Gatham.
If this motion passes, is this the only thing the Groundfish Committee can consider?
Sally?
No, the intention is not to take wholesale what has been presented, but to use those reports as a starting point for an aspect of Amendment 16 that is hugely lacking and that's been pointed out as hugely lacking for a long time. So, you know, there was some discussion about whether 50% or 20% observer coverage is more appropriate overlaid with electronic monitoring rather than the 0, 50, or 100%, which were the options that are laid out. But the intent here is to use this as a starting point for discussion that has been almost entirely lacking at the committee level. And I mean we haven't developed anything at the committee level that's really substantive on monitoring. There's you know, if you look at the document that we have, there are a couple of pages on monitoring, one on area specific reporting requirements and changes to how VTRs are used, but you know, I think everybody is recognizing that we need to take some steps further if we're actually going to get to the point where either, you know, whether it's at sectors or another approach under a catch limited fishery, we're going to have a different kind of monitoring system. So this, we have a little time here, and why not take that time to look at a fundamentally important issue to making the kind of transition in the fishery that I think everybody is really wanting to get us off of days at sea. The only way we're going to be able to do that is if we have another monitoring system. To get back to the question, no, I wouldn't say that the three options and the sub-options that were laid out in the reports that we received would be it, but they would be the starting point for discussion so that the committee can hash through the details.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. I just didn't want the committee to be hamstrung to just dealing with that report and not being able to consider any other options.
George.
Yeah, I strongly agree that monitoring is going to be very critical for whatever programs you're likely to put in place. So I would encourage you to look at this as well as other options to make sure that the document is clear as to how we would monitor.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I strongly support this motion for the same reason that I was somewhat lukewarm on the last one. I want us to move as quickly as we can with any kind of action or proposal for an action that will help to mitigate the effects that might occur down the line if the agency finds it necessary to go to an executive action, or rather to an emergency action. So I strongly recommend this and any other motions like it to keep the committee moving into the area of mitigating effects, particularly that will come into play later on. Thank you.
Tom Neese.
You know, one of the issues with monitoring is that at the committee level and the PDT level, there's really not much expertise in developing monitoring systems. We frankly don't think we have that expertise on the PDT, and we related that to the committee, I think, last summer. I would hope that the council would at least express a request to the service that they participate very actively in this discussion and development of monitoring programs. You know, frankly, outside of, you know, some comments they've given us on the area reporting and asking people to report in areas, I don't know that we really know what the service thinks is needed for monitoring the sector program or for monitoring annual catch limits. And, you know, it's almost like we're shooting at a target and we don't know what it is. So it might be helpful if there was a little more active discussion with the service on these particular issues. And maybe the service fully plans to do that, but it's been an issue so far. Now, the Observer program has been very active in a lot of our discussions at the committee level, but some of the other things, you know, what level of monitoring do they think is necessary dockside? You know, we've got the reports from Archipelago, with very high percentages, but, you know, we don't really know if that's what the service thinks is necessary or not.
George, do you think we could expect the agency to participate vigorously in the at the committee level, or at least transmit some more specifics to the council on the issue of monitoring? I know in the past you have difficulty responding to an open-ended question like that because you're not responding to specific management measures.
Right. Certainly we consider this to be very important and have all along, and I think we've given some suggestions as to how to do this. And we will continue to do what we can and to pull in the people that have the expertise to try to guide you. But I think it's the fine point between you deciding what kind of a program you want and how you want it to work and us trying to help with how exactly that would be implemented. But certainly we'll continue to work with you and Tom and other PDT members to to get that into the document if it's not there now.
Okay. Dr. Weinberg.
Now, I think that the folks at the Science Center should play a role in this discussion as well, because the in determining the level of coverage that might be needed to monitor, as well as perhaps gathering data that is potentially of also of use in stock assessment, which is also often the way these data are used. And from the presentation this morning, it sounded like it's almost like these different options, some cost more than others, and with option A, you get the power windows, and with option B, you get a stripped-down version or so forth. So I think that the center should be in the discussion so that they're aware of what things will be measured and that it would be consistent with their needs.
To the motion, anyone? Council? Jim Ireland.
Well, to be quite blunt, the question is going to be, what is adequate? And that's not going to be up to the committee to come up with that, or the service. It should be up to the council to kind of figure out, what are you trying to accomplish? Are you trying to get statistical information, or are you trying to make sure that everybody's, I'm not sure the term, but that's going to be the question. What is adequate? Because service, to me, is going to say, we want 100% coverage. That's adequate. We know that's adequate, but is 50%, is 20%? If we don't have a range of what's going to be adequate, it's going to be very difficult for people to come up with a plan that meets the term when we get to the service and get looking for approval. What is adequate compared to what? Compared to where we are today? So, you know, all I can do is look across and see the Canadians doing this ITQ system with 20% coverage. So for me, I would say, well, we're sharing the stock. Let's shoot for 20%, see where that goes. So I think we need a little bit of guidance on what we're trying to accomplish.
Who else on the council? Dave?
Yeah, I guess I'd say this just seems to take us back to yesterday's conversation about SBRM, and you know, that's that whole process is how you get to that level of coverage that you need, and then what I heard in the presentation earlier today was it depends on your particular management strategy what level of coverage you need, and if it's simply to verify 100% retention, then some of these programs fit, and so I'm not sure exactly what all the, you know, the PDT would be doing here.
Well, when we've had discussions about quota monitoring in the past and quota management, council members have raised the issue of quota busting. In other words, throwing fish over that, if you were to land them, would terminate your fishing year. So that's something that needs to be considered as well. Are you comfortable with a lower level of coverage and an assumed or an implied discard rate that could be updated monthly, quarterly, somewhat like they do out in U.S. Canada, or do you want to pay the price to live by everything you catch? Because you think that'll actually is a better economic decision for you. So it's finding that sweet spot between paying just enough to keep the season rolling as opposed to paying for 100% coverage and not getting the return. So that's one of the things that you would look at, the possibility of quota busting. I agree. The council needs to define what it's looking for in a monitoring program and what concerns it has. I'm not sure we're prepared to do that today. I'm not sure that, as Tom pointed out, if we send it to the PDT or the committee, we're going to get anything other than what we've gotten. But we do have a report that has three alternatives that range from very low to very high, and utilize both human and electronic monitoring. And I think, let's kick it to the committee. It doesn't mean the council members or even the public that's received the report today can't send comments to the council as we move forward. It's just one element that's been identified as something that's lacking in the document or potentially lacking in the document that we can work on between now and the GARM. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Fourteen opposed. Two abstentions. Motion carries 14-2. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As usual, the groundfish committee information is behind tab number 3. Today, the primary document.